Welcome back. This is Dave Douglas.
I'm Michael Bates.
This is A Noise from the Deep.
The Greenleaf Music Podcast.
That's right. And we're talking to Stephanie Richards, great composer and trumpeter today.
Yep, from Canada.
Oh, a fellow Canadian. Mm-hmm. You must be so proud.
I am proud.
Come visit greenleafmusic.com, the website, for more information.
Yeah, lots of stuff. Lots of stuff. And you can listen to previous episodes of A Noise from the Deep there as well.
So, without further ado, Stephanie Richards. Hey, Stephanie, this is Dave Douglas. I'm with Michael Bates. We're calling you for the podcast. Thanks for coming on the call.
Of course. Thank you so much for asking me.
Well, you're a very inspirational trumpet player and composer, and I just thought you're doing something that not a lot of people are doing, and it would be interesting to talk about. And what I have in mind is all this stuff with music and theater.
Yeah.
The pieces that you've written about that, the Rotations piece for the Carousel. Did that come from your work at UCSD in San Diego, or...?
I guess, you know, I studied classical music for so long before I actually found the courage to start improvising. Hmm. And I've always really loved opera. So I think that part of that, my love of theater and stage and has come from that a little bit. But I also believe in there's a theater in how all art is presented, whether it's like a painting in an art gallery, you know, the theater of the lighting in the wall, or for musicians, there's theater involved wherever we're performing. So mm-hmm. at least right now, I'm really excited about exploring that aspect.
So there's a bunch of pieces. You know, there's the Rotations, there's Trading Futures, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And both Dave and I got to see you do the Rotations performance, and for the listeners out there, who don't know, there's this beautiful carousel right on Brooklyn Bridge Park, underneath the Brooklyn Bridge, right on the water, and it's actually inside a clear glass enclosure, and there's this old carousel. And then you happen to actually live a couple of blocks away from another carousel in Prospect Park, right?
That's right, yeah, it's right across the street, yeah.
So did you do all the rehearsals in Prospect Park?
Oh my gosh, that would be amazing, actually. We ended up having very minimal rehearsal for that piece, just because that particular carousel, I wrote music for that carousel, which has a very different calliope organ setup than the one in Prospect Park. And, you know, the size of it is different. And since the musicians were choreographed as well, we had to kind of make sure that the piece would work just for that specific carousel. So it's not a universal carousel piece.
So you were interacting with the music from the carousel.
Yeah, actually.
Right, of course.
Yeah, yeah. I got to compose music for that particular carousel. And I was, a lot of carousels are still run up by piano roll, actually, mm-hmm. which I thought would be very beautiful. It's sort of like a tape piece. That carousel in Dumbo was MIDI driven. So it was a little easier actually to compose directly, you know, into my computer and play back. But it was essentially a tape piece. So we had to try to make sure we were always playing in time with the carousel, and it was definitely a challenge.
Yeah.
While riding on horses.
Yeah, and
wearing masks and
and playing trumpet.
Yeah. And trumpet. Yes, I owe those guys a couple of beers for that. It was a lot of work. It was all memorized and there were some really great players on that show.
Did Kenny Wollison have some access to the MIDI click tempo wise, or was everybody just listening to what was happening?
I thought we'd be able to just be able to listen, but it turned out after our first rehearsal that we needed somebody inside the carousel with, you know, headphones on. So Andrew Muncie actually was sort of hidden behind the scenes playing inside, and he was playing snare drum and just like smacking, you know, like playing it really loud so that the other two percussionists, so Kenny Wollison and Nick Jenkins, could hear him, and so we could all really groove together. Mm-hmm. So he was actually a very crucial part of that. Once we got there were a lot of logistics. Even as a composer, I realized I'd written the piece to be one way and realized that it just couldn't be that way. There were so many other logistics involved that we had to sort of keep those in mind as we were performing, and even improvising, there were sort of a little more strict confines with that. Yeah, it was tons of fun.
back to the theatrical element of it. I mean, it's not something that I've ever done, and I have thought about it a little bit, but as a composer, I just don't think that way, and I find that it's so remarkable to see, you know, for you, a big part of the piece, as it was what you're saying, you love opera, and mm-hmm. That comes out of a maybe a more classical composition approach, but moving people around and the choreography, it's very intense and very difficult.
Is
that central to the way that you think about composition?
I also believe so much in improvisation too. And I think that that whatever space you're in, you have to play it. And I know, I mean, jazz musicians do it all the time where they're, you know, luckily we've got mics and monitors to help, but we all have to play the space no matter where we are. So I guess I'm just capitalizing on that.
I don't, you know, go down to the Vanguard and then start running around and doing backflips like you guys do. Well, I mean, like when I saw you with the Asphalt Orchestra, that's really tough choreography to remember and to execute and play.
It is. And it's also, I'm still working to find, you know, even for me, how the relationship between movement and music and playing the space can really work together instead of working against. Because very quickly, if the balance is off, if there's too much choreography, or if you're too concerned about people being in, you know, on the other side of the room and they're still trying to play the music, but you know, they can't hear each other or they're out of time and out of sync. There's a lot of challenges to try to compose for those other variables, but I'm also so interested in them. I think there's so much magic that can be made. You know, I actually have trouble sometimes writing a piece that can ever be performed more than once, because I always write for one space and for certain musicians. So, it ends up being a lot of work.
I was going to ask about that. Is there an overarching or like an idea of there being a musical takeaway, that something is going to stand on its own without the setting? Because I mean, I've played a little bit of your music and played more like just instrumental based music, and it's very cinematic. It's very like a lot of themes, there's a storyline to what you do, very involved. But with these more theater-based pieces, is there a musical takeaway too?
I'm not sure. I mean, we'll see. For the ones that I've written so far, I think they've really been written for that moment. But in the future, I'd be open if the music can stand or move somewhere else, or I would be happy to do that as well.
Going back to that rotations thing, I don't think I knew that it was written in concert with the music from the carousel. I guess I did. But it was so seamless that I kind of assumed that that was something you could do anywhere. Really interesting.
Well, it was part of the Festival of New Trumpet Music. And, you know, we've subsequently talked about, okay, how could we get a repeat performance of that piece? And, you know, as much as to my ears and eyes, it was coming out of this feeling of the carousel and the music and the experience and the visual, the people from the carousel maybe didn't quite see it as much that way. And so to get a repeat performance at Jane's Carousel in Brooklyn Pitch Park might be a little tricky. And, you know, so we've talked about, you know, where else would you put it on? And, you know, I'm sure there'll be a way that piece will be performed again, because the music was so wonderful. So to switch gears a little bit, you have this new trio that you've been working with Stomu Takeshi and Kenny Wollison. We'll hear a little bit of this piece, Shape Number 5. But do you want to talk about it? It seems, on listening to it, it seems like maybe a convergence between your gestural vocabulary and an improvising jazz-ish trio.
Those two performers, I met Kenny Wollison through playing with Butch Morris's Lucky Chang Orchestra, which is probably one of the biggest influences of my life playing with.
And you're saying Butch Morris?
Butch Morris, yeah.
Great.
And so Kenny and I met each other through that, and then I met Stomu sort of through similar circles of friends. And those musicians are also, they're game for everything and involving found objects and theatrics. I think that they're also open, very open to that. And they're just such incredible musicians. I feel really lucky to be working with them.
And you've written a bunch of music for this trio, or is it a relatively new project for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very new project. Yeah, I wrote a sort of suite, and it was a series of shapes, basically, compositional shapes that we performed, and we're hoping to record in the next few months and
great.
Let it grow from there.
There seems to be a real unified brass community, and you've certainly tapped into it with all the projects that you've done. Dave has certainly tapped into it through Font, and both of you are involved with that. Can you comment on that and what it means to be a part of a larger brass community?
Well, I think, yeah, I've been in New York for 5 years. I think Dave has done incredible things, I mean, in the community through Font, through the festival. In a city like New York, where it's there, you could look at it as there's so much competition and everyone could be out to get each other. But I think that it's so important actually that we all stick together and really support each other and hold each other up. And I think Dave through Font, and also just being, you know, the wonderful trumpet player that he is really added to creating a really beautiful community in New York. And it's thriving. There's so many incredible brass players here. And yeah, so you got to stick together.
Well, I think when Roy Campbell and I started the Festival of New Trumpet Music, I think it was with the observation that, you know, drummers hang out and bass players hang out and piano players, you know, everybody knows each other. And for horn players, you know, first of all, we're not often on the same gigs together, you know, unless you do a lot of big band work. It's not like,
right.
It seemed like a little isolated.
Wow.
And I thought back to the time, you know, when I first moved to New York, there didn't seem to be a support structure for
interesting.
It.
I mean, I've sort of, the whole time that I've been here has been, I probably in the, you know, around the time that Font started.
So yeah, I think it's also, you know, it's a very competitive instrument just by dint of, you know, the personality of the instrument itself. You kind of have to be a little bit of a battering ram, you know, to lead the band forward and
those high notes.
not so much the high notes, but, you know, it's a very percussive instrument too,
for sure.
You know, a lot of
absolutely.
The impact. So trumpet players tend to be competitive and, you know, hopefully in a good way, but it seemed like, yes, there needed to be some effort to make a community and bring players together and create opportunities for people who are just coming on the scene and also to celebrate, you know, some of the real masters of the instrument and leaders in the community that maybe have not gotten that kind of attention. And so to have Stephanie Richards step in and be a part of the organization is really wonderful.
Right.
because I think, Stephanie, what's interesting and one of the things I wanted to ask you about was that, you know, you do have this awesome classical technique, and yet you're involved in so many different kinds of music and so many experimental type mm-hmm. situations. For example, playing in Brandon Ross's band is mm-hmm. something that, you know, it's just wonderful to hear a new approach to the trumpet in that environment. It's just exciting, you know, speaking as a fellow trumpet player. So I guess I would ask you, you know, do you feel like, I mean, obviously you've been involved in improvisation for a long time and you know a lot of jazz mm-hmm. And you have this great technique, but do you feel like you're willfully, you know, thinking about expanding the vocabulary of yourself and the instrument as you're doing all these projects? Or is it more just the music is leading you where it's leading you?
I remember, I guess it was just over a year ago, I was hanging out with Butch Morris at his apartment. He was a very incredible mentor. And I remember him just sort of saying with this insistence and looking at me, you know, you've got to do something new. You just have to think about it and be smart and do something new. And I've always believed that, I think, from the beginning, which is why I probably didn't go on and take orchestral auditions and play in a symphony orchestra, because that wasn't as interesting to me as maybe trying to find a new way to hear music or to perform it. But at this stage, I don't think I'm trying to, you know, choose what type. What was that?
Reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, reinvent the wheel, or even choose that, you know, this is my genre, or this is what I'm doing. Maybe I haven't been ready to commit just yet, or I'm not sure. But I think at this stage, I'm just trying to write what I think is interesting and inspiring and exciting, and go play with the musicians that I really believe in, and go see people perform that amaze me. And there are a lot of them in New York. But yeah, that's where I'm at right now. Whether it's jazz or experimental or new music or what, I'm not sure.
So, Chant, the Brandon Ross piece
that
you sent over. What can you tell us about that a little bit?
Well, Brandon he's a beautiful musician. We also met playing in Butch's Lucky Chang Orchestra, and he played a lot with Henry Threadgill, mm-hmm. Who I've performed with before and learned a lot from as well. And so I think there's a common language that we share, and he's a beautiful performer and composer. And this particular piece, it's called Chant, and I just think it's a gorgeous composition that just, you know, those compositions that you hear once and it just you could sing it again immediately, like it just gets in your head right away. I think it comes from a very honest place, and he liked the way I had this one technique of playing sort of a flute flugelhorn sound.
Yeah, are you doing that on a flugelhorn?
I am, yes. So I just took out the mouthpiece and I'm playing without a mouthpiece, but I am playing with a vibrato that typically only flautists use,
right?
Diaphragm, which took a long time to practice, actually. And if you're on a full stomach, it's definitely not to do.
Not advisable.
No.
And so like a shakuhachi type mm-hmm. approach, maybe.
Definitely.
Would you say? Or, uh-huh.
Yeah. And it really fit, I think, with the music. And then also the form of it too is very exploratory. You know, it's not, there's sort of a head, but then from there it's always open of whether we take solos or we solo together, or nobody really knows where it's about to go with that group. But
Thank you. I love Brandon, and he explained some things about working with Henry to me one time, and it was pretty mind-blowing. I don't know if he does he throw some of that stuff at you guys too?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes he'll say some things, and it's really beautiful. Like some things, even that Henry, I mean, it's funny because everybody has different ways of interpreting, I guess, how Henry explains his own music too, which I love, actually. I think everybody sees and hears something different in his compositional process. Like Henry, I remember I was asking him, how does he writes with all these interesting intervals and numbers?
Yeah.
And changes, but they're not actually chord changes. They're just sort of clusters. Mm-hmm. And one time he told me that he was listening a lot to Varese and studying his scores and realized one day that, you know, one note would sort of unfold into another note, and there might not be necessarily a harmonic. This is me. This is my own interpretation, by the way. This is not, I'm curious. Henry might be like, nope, this is not it. Mm-hmm. But the way I understood it was that, you know, he would hear how Varese would have one note that would unfold into another note and into another note, and it kept unfolding in certain intervals and not necessarily through harmonic rules, but more intervallic, and that there's colors found within these beautiful intervals, that mm-hmm. that's its own color. So anyways, I just think it's a very beautiful way to compose, and I think it's definitely influenced the way I think about music.
Yeah, I heard you playing with Henry, you and Jonathan Finlayson
mm-hmm.
were in a section together. It was such an interesting combination. Yeah.
Well, he's incredible too. So it was a lot of fun. That whole band actually was so much fun.
Hope we get to hear that again sometime.
Me too.
So we're going to play to close this out with from the calendar suite.
Oh, okay.
The March. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us something about that?
It's not finished yet, but calendar suite is, you know, I wrote gestures for each month.
Oh.
Very open, free form pieces, and written for trumpet and prepared piano. And so this pianist, Rory Cowell, is a very dear friend of mine. And we practiced playing free for months before we recorded just that little snippet. And there was a few gestures that I'd written, and actually a few sort of written motives, and that was it. But in terms of the form mm-hmm. Or the structure, we didn't actually know exactly where it was going to go. But I really believe in practicing playing free with people. I think that's very important. And so, yeah.
That's interesting, because you might get a lot of pushback from some improvisers on that idea, wouldn't you say?
I know for myself that was definitely something that I think that you can learn so much from being very close to the people that you're playing with.
Yeah, I agree. I just think it's interesting because a lot of times, you know, especially with quote-unquote free improvisation, people think that, you know, it's supposed to be, there's no preparation and, you know, it's really just coming out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, there's so much to be gained from, as you say, you know, playing over and over mm-hmm. with someone. And and so you've developed this piece that comes from a few gestures that identify it as the composition,
mm-hmm.
and yet there's so much freedom to the way that you're able to approach it. It's really, and you feel that in listening to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very effective in that way.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think playing free should always be, you're free in the moment, and you're improvising in the moment. But the better that you can speak similar languages to the musicians you're playing with, or the better you know them, that you can have more of an interesting and spontaneous conversation in that moment. But if it's a stranger, it's, you might not have as deep of a conversation, right? So that's why I believe it's important to play and practice together instead of playing free. It can come out of thin air, but also if you have a relationship with the people you're playing with, it can be that much deeper and that much more potent in a good way.
And what do you, just one last question, you know, how do you prepare as a trumpet player for that level of freedom? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I'm curious your thoughts too on that one. I practice a lot of technique, actually, mm-hmm. Because I think as long as I can be prepared to play anything I want, then in the moment my body will be capable of executing it. So
right.
Most of my practicing is actually purely technique.
Wow. Yeah. And is there any like Adams or Stamp or any of the, you know, Bylin, Carmine Caruso, any method that you've stuck with over the years?
Mm. When I was at Eastman, my teacher was Jim Thompson, and he started this method called Buzzing Basics. And he actually also,
sounds like something that was big in the 60s, buzzing basics. Oh, sorry. Not that kind of buzzing, I guess.
I really appreciated that approach because it was very, there's no thinking really involved. You just execute. And I think he took a lot from other methodologies. So I learned a lot from Jim Thompson as a trumpet player.
And you still use that in your technical warming up and practicing preparation?
I do. Yeah, definitely. Oh, and then also, great. Of course, the most incredible Lori Frank. I only had a couple lessons with her, but the little that I got, I still practice every day. I think she was very, very important to the world of trumpet players from my perspective.
That's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to listen to this the month of March from your calendar suite. And it's been great talking to you. And I hope we get to improvise together sometime.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you guys so much.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Fellow Canadian, Stephanie Richards, great trumpet player.
I wonder, does she play hockey, though? I mean, you keep mentioning the Canadian content. I'm wondering if...
No, we've talked.
Oh,
she's
you have?
She's not a hockey fan.
So maple syrup, but not hockey. Dang. She is such an incredible musician, though,
and
trumpet player.
Yeah.
And it's remarkable to hear somebody who, as she said, you know, came up learning classical and... You know, branched into improvisation and now is doing such incredible work. And it was a great opportunity to speak to her.
Yeah.
Hey, so there's this thing coming down the pike that I thought might be interesting to just mention, which is that courtesy of the Alsop Foundation, there's going to be a Lori Frank Career Grant.
Wow, nice.
She'll be awarded every 2 years to a deserving young trumpeter for... education expenses.
Nice. Like not a professional
like
musician.
An education a career grant
a
is
career
what they're
grant.
Calling
okay.
it and it's in Lori's name and
Lori is a name that comes up pretty much Lori every
Frank,
time you talk about music.
My teacher, yes, and a guidance counselor to so many of us, not just trumpeters but a lot of trumpet players studied with her and still hold her very dear, both as a person and as an educator.
Mm-hmm.
So to have this award in her name, I think, is a wonderful thing. So if you're a young trumpeter and you're looking for that kind of support to either be in school or take lessons, you know, this is a great thing to keep your eye out for. Thank you.
Yeah, so one of the things that we do here on the podcast sometimes is to just talk about music that we've listened to, that's been important to us, that stands the test of time or sometimes not, yeah. Who knows. But that was Henry Cow, the band, which I listened to a lot and was, I think, a big influence for me. Fred Frith, the great guitarist and composer, was in the band, and Peter Blegvad and Chris Cutler and Dagmar Krause and a handful of other people. Worth looking up, Henry Cow. And I think one of the things that I thought was so great about it was that, first of all, is acoustic instruments, but, you know, sounding pretty electrified. Yeah, the way it was recorded, sure, was really interesting, fantastic. And then the compositions are really involved, lots of odd meters, and also bringing in woodwinds, bassoon, and it's kind of like what you might describe as an art rock band, I guess, if you had to put a category name on things. Slap Happy was another band. Art Bears was another band with some of the same members. Predated Fred Frith's work as a soloist, as a leader, and a very important group of British musicians that emerged in the 60s.
Yeah, it's cool stuff.
There's another record that was really important to me. It's an Ornette Coleman record from 1975 that I don't hear talked about all that much. It's called Body Metta.
It's a really cool record.
It's a really great record.
Jamaluddin Takuma,
Charlie Ellerby, Ronald Shannon Jackson, DiNardo Coleman on drums. And it's just really unusual because it's produced to a very high standard.
Yeah.
And, you know, has the electric sounds that were recorded the way that they were recorded in pop music,
sure,
at that,
yeah,
time. And the compositions are just really wild, far out, fantastic stuff. So Ornette Coleman, Body Metta.
Well, that's, yes, the end of another one.
You have spent your time listening to A Noise from the Deep,
the Greenleaf Music Podcast.
Yeah, and it's a great pleasure to share the music, and we hope that you'll subscribe and check it out and leave us a review at iTunes.
Yeah, stop past greenleafmusic.com to check out more about what Greenleaf Music artists are doing and more information about the podcast.
We hope you enjoy it.
Yeah.
And yeah, come on back, y'all.
Thanks.